We've started on our journey with Ecclesiastes, with Kohelet, our teacher. And in particular, I've tried to lay before you the way that Kohelet presents a perspective which is neither all nor nothing. And we live in a very all or nothing kind of world. And that's why I think Ecclesiastes as a word to our world is so very valuable just at this particular time. Kohelet says it's neither all. No, you can't make complete sense of life. It's in its biggest picture, it's vanity, it's hevel, it's like shepherding wind, it's absurd. Things don't work the way they're supposed to work all the time or even most of the time. They should go this direction, but they take a turn this way. It should pan out like this, but it goes pear-shaped. But on the other hand, that doesn't mean that there is no meaning in anything, that it's just abandon ship and just indulge and get a little bit of what you can do because that's all there is to it. No. There's something. There are the small meanings, the pleasures. There are one thing is better than another. Kohelet is neither all nor nothing, and we live in an all or nothing culture that can't handle tension. On the one hand, you see, we live in a grossly overconfident culture. The last 200 years have seen incredible advances in science and therefore technology, and I believe in many ways that that's the product of a divinely given ability to investigate and to understand the world, and so actually functions as the gift of God. But as we do in so many ways, we take a good thing and make it an ultimate thing, and we've turned this gift into an ideology. We press on and on toward ultimate knowledge, and sooner or later we have what science promises to be, do you know what they call it? A theory of everything. A theory of everything. Utter human arrogance. On the other hand, we live in a context that is entirely pessimistic about human meaning and significance. There's no meaning in life, we're told, at least no ultimate meaning. There is no objective truth. There's no heaven or hell. There's no final judgment. There's no right or wrong. There's no basis upon which we could judge a person or a community or a nation, good or bad. In other words, there's no meaning. There's just fun. And so have the most fun that you can pack in. You see how our culture is either all or nothing. What's more, I think we have Christian versions of this same overconfidence and underconfidence. We have the Bible. The Bible is the truth. And that means we know the truth. And of course that's true. But we can take that good thing and turn it into an ultimate thing and become somewhat arrogant about it and slip in the word whole there. We know the whole truth about everything. We have an answer to every question. We can criticise any view that's different from ours. We know where everyone is wrong. On the other hand, we can be underconfident as Christian believers, browbeaten by a hostile media and a changing society, and just retreat. We have our convictions, but they belong in our hearts. They certainly don't belong in the public realm. We should just keep our religion private and respect other people's right to think what they think and therefore not talk to them, as though that was respecting other people's right to think what they want to think. Do you see why I want to suggest that Ecclesiastes gives us a hugely valuable resource? He says, we're fools to be overconfident or underconfident. He gives us a basis to live lives that are humble. Humble in not claiming too much, as though we've got everything figured out just because we have some things figured out. But humble in not claiming too little either, as though we need to keep questioning the Word of God. And Kohelet gives us a basis on which to humbly challenge our neighbours and colleagues and relatives as well. That scientific advance and technological breakthrough give us some things, And when my mother had a hip replacement earlier this year that has just really changed and extended her life quite dramatically, I'm deeply thankful for that. But science and technology don't give us everything. And people's intuition that there has to be more to life than simply retreating to having maximum fun is spot on. Neither all nor everything. That's Ecclesiastes. And that's why it's so relevant in an all or nothing world. I want to suggest that what makes this perspective of Ecclesiastes so absolutely spot on is the words, but actually more than the words, the career of another one who was called the teacher. Jesus Christ was a son of God from all eternity. He had the ultimate truth. He was the ultimate truth. He had the answer to every question, the very glory of the Father. But here's the thing, you see, he gave it up. He emptied himself. He took on the form of a slave. He was found in human form. He became as one of us. He entered our limitations. He took upon himself our limitations. He was tempted. And he suffered. And he didn't know the time. Remember he says that? It's not for anyone other than the Father to know the time. He took up our place so that by union with him through faith, we can take up his place. We can be adopted as children of God. And as the Apostle John puts it, this is 1 John chapter 3, beloved, we are God's children now. That's a pole in the ground. What we will be has not yet been revealed. We know something. We don't know everything, but we don't know nothing either. But what we do know is this, when he is revealed, we will be like him, for we will see him as he is. And all who have this hope in him purify themselves, just as he is pure. So, I want to suggest that this perspective of Ecclesiastes is very powerfully valuable. Let's move on then to the question of power. There are lots of topics that Ecclesiastes deals with. You could look at the topic of wisdom, for example. You could look at the topic of achievement. We're going to look at the topic of power as just one of a number of issues that the teacher touches on to just deepen his exploration of the absurdity of life. I remember being in one of those discussions which start reasonable and rational and then get vehement and loud. If you want to be the personality type to engage in one of those discussions, and I used to be, but I'm not anymore. Those conversations which are more sources of heat than light. It was with a lesbian feminist social worker friend of mine. Anyway, I made one of my more silly comments in defence of what she called the system, and then she went on and said, quote, "You would think that, wouldn't you? You tick every power category there is. You're male, white, educated, Western, heterosexual, and wealthy." And that was the end of the discussion. Once you've been boxed like that, there's really nothing much more you can say, is there, actually? Kohelet has a modest proposal for life. That's the way I put it. A modest proposal for life, which recognises both the possibilities as well as the limits of life and wisdom. We've said that his is a middle way in an all or nothing world, which doesn't break itself on the rocks of the world's intractability, nor spit the dummy and head for Nimbin. Or at least, I'm not sure what the Tasmanian equivalent of Nimbin is. Well, someone give us a suggestion? Signet. Okay. Don't go there. But rather, he does. I'm going to take my jacket off. I'm a bit warm. It's a modest proposal for life that does what it can, fearing God, knowing that there's a time for everything under the sun. That's chapter 3. And that God has made it this way so that we should fear him. As I say, we're going to look at power, which if we don't get our heads straight on this question, we'll find ourselves acting like fools, as the teacher says. I fill all six power categories. And it's worth asking yourself how many you do as well. The chances are it's quite a few. And if you're tempted to exclude yourself from the wealthy category, I think pretty much everyone is tempted to exclude themselves from the wealthy category because we all know someone who's wealthier than us. We all compare up. Well, then just wait till the end of the talk. In world terms, we are powerful people destined for only greater and greater power, especially if you're young. And you know what they say about power, Lord Acton's dictum? Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And he goes on and says, great men are almost always bad men. Very interesting, isn't it? The teacher looks at two forms of power, economic power, the power of wealth, and political power, the power of rulers. And he speaks words of clarity and wisdom about both. Firstly, then, wealth. We live in a world as much now as then of abject economic oppression. It's very, very important that you don't insulate yourself from this reality. Spend your money, purchase, in the light of the reality that 1 billion people in the world won't get enough to eat this day. They're 8,500 kilojoules. While at the same time, obesity in the Western world is at record levels. Purchase in the light of the reality that in the last 50 years, 400 million people have died from hunger and poor sanitation. Three times the number killed in wars. That in developing countries, 6 million children die each year, mostly from hunger-related causes, and that ending hunger is not relatively expensive. It's estimated at $20 billion a year or so. There are plenty of people who could give that away and not even notice it. Spend your money in the light of the fact that the Western world spends more than this annually on pet food. The teacher knew these realities as well as anyone. Chapter 4, verse 1, again, I saw all the oppressions that are practiced under the sun. Look, the tears of the oppressed with no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors there was power and no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead who had already died more fortunate than the living who are still alive, but better than both is the one who has not yet been born, has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. The world is a miserable place for many people, oppressed with no one to comfort them, no one to assist in changing their circumstances. And the teacher says, better to be dead, at least they have rest, but better still never to have been born. Where does this oppression come from? Kohelet sees with piercing clarity, verse 4, then I saw all that all toil and all skill in work come from one person's envy of another. This also is vanity and a chasing after wind. Envy. Envy is what drives people to perpetuate a world in which some are up and most are down. Envy. The dissatisfaction with what I have, but even more deeply than that, I think envy is deeper than jealousy. It's the dissatisfaction with who I am and the desire for what someone else has and is. Whether it's beauty or intelligence or luxuries or opportunities or success or fame or wealth, you see others and you want it. Envy is comparing your situation to others, or even comparing your situation to some dream you have, and in the comparison, finding yourself wanting. and so becoming demanding. You start thinking that what God has for you doesn't stack up compared to what God has for someone else, and that deep down, God is not good, at least not to you. You see how it's the loosening of the grip on one of the poles? Years ago, I used to live next door to the rectory when I was an assistant minister at St. Barnabas Broadway, just opposite Sydney University. We used to have a kitchen that was upstairs, which is a strange place to have a kitchen, but there you go. And that meant that when we were in our kitchen, we could see out the window of the side of the house, out the side window, and onto the back deck of the next door, which was where the rectory was. So I was in the curatage, which was half the size of the rectory, not that I'm bitter about that. And I would look down onto the back deck of the rectory. And of an evening, when I would be feeding the kids, because veterinarians have to work after hours, so my wife would be late home at 7:30 or 8, and I'd had these little kids, and there's spaghetti flying to all parts of the room, and I'm trying to shove some good green stuff into mouths like beans or broccoli, and drinks are being spilled all over the place, I would glance onto that deck. And there would be my boss and his wife, who had adult children. And they'd be sitting quietly on the deck, sipping their tingling drinks, reading books. I remembered what a book was at that stage. I hadn't seen one for a while. Making phone calls before wandering off down to Glebe Point Road for a quick bite to eat. I remember seeing a classmate from school 5 years or so after we left school. Just, again, one of these funny moments when I spotted him in traffic driving down the other side of the road as I went south down King Street and he went north up King Street. I do need to forgive him. And he was in his big, beautiful, black, convertible BMW. And I was in a Subaru Sherpa. He was dumber than me. He was less motivated than me. He had nothing on me except my 660 cc's of rippling power really didn't compare to his BMW. And you know what the word here that counts is, of course? It's compare. Because, well, yeah, that's right. He was in debt up to his eyeballs, as was I, actually, now that I think about it. It's in the comparison that our discontent rises. And the teacher says it's vanity. This pursuit of the other. It can never get anywhere. You can't have it all. So does that mean we just give up? Well, actually, by now we know the teacher well enough to predict that that's not where he's going to go, don't we? Verse 5, fools fold their hand and consume their own flesh. Don't go to Nimbin, Siget, Signet. Better is a handful with quiet than two handfuls with toil and a chasing after wind. See, fools fold their hands, simply sit back and do nothing. And fools live in ceaseless striving, never satisfied, always driven, always anxious. The path of wisdom is neither folded hands nor two handfuls with toil, but a handful, just a handful, enough. Not too little, not too much. A handful with quiet. The teacher goes on to describe the envious person always wanting more and yet having nothing. Verse 7, again, I saw vanity under the sun, the case of solitary individuals without sons or brothers, yet there was no end to all their toil, and their eyes are never satisfied with riches. For whom am I toiling, they ask, and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business. Their eyes are never satisfied with riches. It is a vanity. Listen to how one fool put it. I read a comment made by a man called Harold Hart, whose stock market investing had made him exceedingly rich. A business colleague of his reported a conversation of a meeting the two of them had, and this is what he said. "When I arrived, I found Harold Hart resting in his favourite chair with servants waiting on him hand and foot. I sat there waiting as he stared blankly into space. Finally, Harold muttered, 'You know, nature has played a great hoax on man. You work all your life, go through an endless number of struggles, play all the petty little games, and if you're lucky, you finally make it to the top. Well, I made it a long time ago, and you know what? It doesn't mean a damn thing. Nature's made a fool of man, and the biggest fool of all is me. Here I sit in poor health, exhausted from years of playing the game, well aware that time is running out, and I keep asking myself, now what, genius? What's your next brilliant move going to be? All that time I spent worrying, manoeuvring, it was meaningless. Life is nothing but a big hoax. We think we're so important, but the truth is, we're nothing.'" It's like he'd been reading half of Ecclesiastes, isn't it, actually? Chapter 5 deepens the same theme, verse 10. The lover of money will not be satisfied with money, nor the lover of wealth with gain. This also is vanity. When goods increase, those who eat them increase. And what gain has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of labourers, whether they eat little or much, but the surfeit of the rich will not let them sleep. This is our consumerist world, driven by the high priests of dissatisfaction, the marketers. At one level, of course, we're all consumers engaged in the activity of consumption. God created us as physical beings, and so we eat and we drink and we create shelters and we wear clothes. And given that not many of us grow or make things very much anymore, the way we do that is by making purchases. Of course, we're consumers. It's just a neutral thing, although the use of the word consume, which originally means to destroy, is perhaps a little unfortunate. But consumerism is different, isn't it? Consumerism is consumption as an idol, consumption that tends not merely the body, but rather something that promises to feed the soul. And you see this best in the sacrament of consumerism, which is the advertising industry. Advertising is built around the principle of hiding a product behind a promise. That's how advertising works. You hide a product behind a promise. You sell margarine not by telling people that it works to make toast a little soggy and easier to chew. That's not going to sell much margarine. Instead, you sell margarine by telling people you ought to be congratulated and showing people scenes of domestic bliss with six teenagers enthusiastically eating the exact food that a perfectly unstressed mother has provided after a frolic in an immaculate backyard. All, of course, totally unbelievable. It's never happened. But that's not the point. It's desperately desired. Mothers of six children kind of would like someone to say to them, "You really ought to be congratulated." And so the marketer says, "Here's our margarine for you, because this will make you the mother you yearn to be." It's a trick, right? It's just a trick. The link between this product and this promise of a kind of life that you want, the kind of person that you want to be. Buy this product and you'll be this kind of person. You'll be this cool. Coke adds life. What rot? Actually, it is rot. You put your teeth in it and it rots. But you show enough pictures of those people who just look unbelievably good because they are. It's all airbrushed. They're not actually who they are. Enough pictures of that and people buy Coke by the litre. Your soul will be filled, your problems solved, and your ego stroked. But of course it doesn't work. It can never work because products can never feed our souls. Buying the right butter will never turn you into a good mum. Drinking Coke will never add life. And as you move on to the next cycle, because it didn't really work, you have to consume more and the addiction process just sets in, and whatever it might be. And the advertising gurus stoke the fires of our desires and at the same time ensure that they're never truly satisfied. Both together. So the next time we need a bigger hit. I heard a joke about the inventor of the unbreakable children's toy who was assassinated. Because who wants to sell an unbreakable children's toy? You only sell it once. We become consumption idolaters, falling for the two-pronged attack that idolatry always makes, distracting us from the real issues of the soul, character and meaning and duty, and leading us to the banal and trivial, or if that doesn't work, telling us that those soul issues can be satisfied somewhere apart from God. We learn that if we're feeling a little bit down, then what we need is some retail therapy. That's such a revealing phrase. Get shopping is the answer to everything. Notice how utterly unchristian it all is. Not just unchristian, it's anti-Christian. We're taught to be self-centered, not other person-centered. We're taught to eliminate pain, not sin. We're taught to pursue fun, not character. Instant gratification, not patience. Self-awareness, not self-examination. We're taught to see ourselves as isolated individuals seeking satisfaction, not members of a body where sacrifice frequently makes sense. And it is the raging current in the stream of our society. It is perhaps the defining aspect of our age, consumerism. Self-satisfaction. Billions of dollars are spent annually on this education campaign, and it works beautifully. The media industry has overtaken the arms industry as the largest industry in the world. 2,000 to 3,000 times a day, their images assault your eyes. And of course, you're entirely immune to it all, aren't you? The truth is, consumerism will break your heart because your heart does not belong in things but in God and in people. See how the teacher puts it in chapter 5, verse 13. There is a grievous ill that I've seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owners to their hurt. And those riches were lost in a bad venture. Though they are parents of children, they have nothing in their hands. As they came from their mother's womb, so they shall go again, naked as they came. They shall take nothing for their toil, which they may carry away with their hands. This also is a grievous ill. Just as they came, so shall they go. And what gain do they have from toiling for the wind? Besides, all their days they eat in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and resentment. This is a dreadful lot, the idolatry of wealth. It's like all idolatries. In the end, it destroys you. If what you worship is not the true and living God, it will crush you, because it can never deliver what it offers. It's a depressing picture, isn't it? Especially, as I said, I'd suggest that if you have a job or own a house in the Western world, if you have a job or own a house in the Western world, then you are a member of the richest 1% of all human beings that have ever lived. Now, I know there are some people who own more jobs and more houses than you. They're in the richest half of 1%. But I still think that the top 1% still counts as wealthy. Is it possible for the wealthy not to be greedy in their wealth? Chapter 5, verse 18. This is what I've seen to be good. It is fitting to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of the life God gives us, for this is our lot. Likewise, all to whom God gives wealth and possessions and whom he enables to enjoy them and to accept their lot and find enjoyment in their toil. This is the gift of God. For they will scarcely brood over the days of their lives because God keeps them occupied with the joy of their hearts. Again, you see why under the sun can't mean apart from God. Now, here is a shard of hope. Not everything, not nothing. Contentment. Wealth without greed. Ecclesiastes is hopeful, but John Wesley was less hopeful. Two centuries ago, he wrote these words, I quote, "I fear wherever riches have increased, the essence of religion has decreased in the same proportion. Wherever riches have increased, the essence of religion has decreased in the same proportion. Therefore, I do not see how it is possible in the nature of things for any revival of true religion to continue long." Right, Wesley was part of the Great Awakening that took place in England and the United States in the 18th century. Why? Why is it not possible in the nature of things for any revival of true religion to continue long? Well, because religion must necessarily produce both industry, hard work, and frugality, that is, not indulgence. And these cannot but produce riches. And as riches increase, so will pride, anger, and love of the world in all its branches. And he concludes, is there no way to prevent this continual decay of pure religion? We ought not to prevent people from being diligent and frugal and Christian in how they do their work. And almost in despair, he says, we must exhort all Christians to gain all they can, to save all they can. That is, in effect, to grow rich. Perhaps Ecclesiastes joins Wesley, chapter 6, verse 1. There is an evil that I've seen under the sun, and it lies heavy upon humankind. Those to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honour so that they lack nothing of all that they desire, yet God does not enable them to enjoy these things, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity, it is a grievous ill. A man may beget 100 children and live many years, but however many are the days of his years, if he does not enjoy life's good things or has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes into vanity and goes into darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good. Do not all go to the one place. This is the dreadful indigestion of materialism, a person bloated on his own possessions so that he can never enjoy what he has. And the teacher shocks us. It's a shocking thing to say. Better is a stillborn child whose life is over before it begins, but at least finds rest. The teacher has two predictably modest suggestions: contentment and community. Contentment, we saw previously, it's better a handful with quiet than two handfuls with toil and a chasing after the wind. The teacher invites you to settle in your heart what are your real goals in life. I was chatting with a friend some time ago. She made the point that when you're in your 90s and dribbling in a nursing home and someone else does your toileting for you, this friend was a vet and a bit preoccupied with the rather unsavoury side of life. What is it that matters to you then? What do you look back on with pride and satisfaction? And what really doesn't matter? We agreed that it's the relationships that you invested in. It's the God you worshipped and the people you loved and the contribution you make, not the things or the experiences you bought during your time. In the end, the fact is that contentment really is not related to what you have. Satisfaction is not produced by what you do or don't buy. You hear often enough of people who don't have a lot being quite content. At the same time, people have enormous wealth and resources and luxury being far from content. Apparently, when Rockefeller was asked how much was enough, he said, a little more than you have. The Western world has never been wealthier, more technologically equipped, with more means of communication and transportation, and at the same time, I suspect, has never been more depressed, more medicated, more desperate, or in other words, more discontent. And surely satisfaction is related to living above that level, where the things that we purchase are not the things that deal fatal or even devastating blows to your inner being and what really counts in life. Contentment. But second is community. A community which is the opposite of envy. Envy is me. Community is we. Envy is zero sum. I get up by getting on top of you and pushing you down, taking what you have. Community is an expanding pie, that together we work and achieve more than our competition will allow. You see it in chapter 4, verse 9. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up the other. But woe to one who is alone and falls and does not have another to help. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though one might prevail against another, two will withstand one. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. So here's the way of wisdom, you see. Contentment in community. It's not all, and it's not nothing. It's classic Kohelet. Contentment in community. Not isolated, lonely envy. Don't be corrupted by the material power that you have. Power tends to corrupt. Absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. And what Ecclesiastes says is, don't be corrupted by the material power that you have so that it eats up your soul. There's another power that the teacher is interested in, the power of rulers. But this time it's from the other side. It's not from those who wield the power. It's from the perspective of those over whom the power is wielded. The way of the world with political power is much the same as it is with economic power, namely oppression. And again, this is how the vast majority of human beings live. George Steiner, who is a philosopher and commentator who has the post of extraordinary fellow at Churchill College, Cambridge, I've always thought if ever I was to change job, I would like to be called extraordinary fellow at some Cambridge college, but I doubt that it's going to happen. Anyway, he was, and this is what he wrote. Inhumanity is, so far as we have historical evidence, perennial. There have been no utopias, no communities of justice or forgiveness. He goes on more specifically, for the whole of Europe and Russia, the 20th century became a time out of hell. Historians estimate at more than 70 million the number of men, women and children done to death by warfare, starvation, deportation, political murder and disease between August 1914 and the ethnic cleansing in the Balkans. He makes this point, this is just chilling. He says, it is not only that education has shown itself incapable of making sensibility and thought resistant to murderous unreason. Let me just unpack. He's saying, it's not only that education has failed to stop this. Far more disturbingly, the evidence is that refined intellectuality, artistic virtuosity and appreciation, scientific eminence, in other words, education, will collaborate actively with totalitarian demands or at best remain indifferent to surrounding sadism. Education just means we damage each other in more sophisticated ways. That's what his point is. To repeat, he concludes, violence, oppression, economic enslavement, and social irrationality have been endemic in history, whether tribal or metropolitan, but the 20th century has, owing to the magnitude of the massacre, to the insane contrast between available wealth and actual misery, to the probability that thermonuclear and bacterial weapons could in fact terminate man or his environment, given to despair a new warrant. He says it gives us even better reason than ever to head into despair. If you resist the temptation to simply numb out, if you take all of this with full seriousness, it renders plausible the famous saying of the existentialist philosopher Albert Camus, the only serious philosophical question is that of suicide. Now, some of you know this. You rail against it. You're determined to change things, to fight the system, to make a difference. The all. Others see the sad faces on World Vision ads just too many times and experience what's called compassion fatigue. Too many little children, too many dead bodies. And after a while, we become just resigned, or at worst, indifferent, and crack open another bottle of wine. Nothing. Listen to the teacher's wisdom, which is not the way of naive utopia, nor of collusion by default. Chapter 8, verse 2. Keep the king's command because of your sacred oath. Do not be terrified. Go from his presence. Do not delay when the matter is unpleasant, for he does whatever he pleases, for the word of the king is powerful. Who can say to him, what are you doing? Whoever obeys a command will meet no harm, and the wise mind will know the time and way. For every matter has its time and way, though the troubles of mortals lie heavy upon them. Here is the path of realism, says Ecclesiastes, in the face of political power. The king does whatever he pleases. And who can say to him, you idiot, what are you doing? You know what this is like? At work, your boss really has little to no idea. I'm not speaking to Victor here. Your boss has little to no idea, but the chances of him or her actually listening to someone who does is about zero. And so even if you disagree, even if you hate the way that power is used, the teacher says, don't show it. Find a way forward. This is the way of the wise. But the wise also know that there is a time and a way for everything, even a time for the judgment of kings, verse 7. Indeed, they do not know what is to be, for who can tell them how it will be? No one has power over the wind to restrain the wind, or power over the day of death. There is no discharge from the battle, nor does wickedness deliver those who practice. All this I observed, applying my mind to all that is done under the sun, while one person exercises authority over another to the other's hurt. But again, this realism doesn't mean the teacher's given up. It's not all or nothing. He knows that even in a world in which the wicked prosper and the poor are trampled, at least for now, he can still trust in God, verse 10. Then I saw the wicked buried. They used to go in and out of the holy place and were praised in the city where they had done such things. This also is vanity. Because sentence against an evil deed is not executed speedily, the human heart is fully set to do evil. Though sinners do evil 100 times and prolong their lives, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God because they stand in fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, neither will they prolong their days like a shadow, because they do not stand in fear before God. And so he draws his conclusion in this modest proposal for life. There is a vanity that takes place on earth that there are righteous people who are treated according to the conduct of the wicked, and there are wicked people who are treated according to the conduct of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. So I commend enjoyment, for there is nothing better for people under the sun than to eat, drink, and enjoy themselves, for this will go with them in their toil through the days of life that God gives them under the sun. Kohelet says, face the fact that you live in a world where you will constantly run into injustice, seeing people oppressed. Oh, do check and make sure that you are not the oppressor. If you have power, be very careful that you don't bring injustice onto someone else, especially in how you treat people who are weaker than you. If you have a sharp, smart tongue, for example, then curb it and find ways to use words that don't damage others. At the same time, you'll be the victim of injustice at some point or other. You can guarantee it. Perhaps small, perhaps big. For most, that creates bitterness and viciousness. Sometimes even worse than the injustice in the first place. And the model here is Jesus, who in 1 Peter did not return abuse, didn't threaten. Instead, he entrusted himself to the one who judges justly. Don't lash out. Entrust yourself to the one who judges justly. Speak up against injustice, yes, like Jesus. But don't seek private revenge. Respond, aware that there is a real judgment to come. The teacher knew enough to keep him going, but it was the path neither of naivety, we can fix this, it will get worked out, nor of despair, who cares? A modest proposal. Well, we've talked about power. It's an ugly topic, actually, power. It almost always hurts people, is the way things go in this world. That's what the teacher says. And that is inevitable. It's the pattern of the fool to try and restrain the wind. Again, it seems to me that our world is deeply confused about power and its abuse. On the one hand, we hear again and again and again that the only universal wrong is discriminating against other people, that everyone has the right to determine what's right for them as long as they don't damage other people. That's one extreme, simply giving up, looking after number one. On the other hand, there's a deep concern for what we've come to call universal human rights, the call to take the misery of others seriously, to ensure that their human rights are preserved, to work for justice, to give to charities, to save the planet. This is the other extreme. Everyone has the right to do what they want, except, no, we've got to preserve everyone's universal human rights. You see this confusion. We sort of live in this all or nothing world. But Kohelet is far wiser. He gives us a sobering dose of our actual place in things, and says that for us who will listen to his wisdom, the only safe place for the use of power is in the fear of God. The only alternative to the idolatrous use of power is laying down that power in worship of the true and living God. Because we know the one who had all power, We know the one who is the creator and has the power of judgment. But on the cross, instead of grasping onto that power, he gave it up. Or perhaps, maybe better, he demonstrated that real power is enacted in service. That victory comes through sacrifice. That all authority in heaven and on earth is given to the one who becomes the servant obedient to death, even death on a cross. And when you trust in this one as your Lord, when you set your heart upon him, when you fill your vision with him, then your heart is melted and you find yourself more and more a servant with your power, not a tyrant. Listen again to the teacher, chapter 5, verse 1. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. To draw near to listen is better than the sacrifice offered by fools, for they do not know how to keep from doing evil. Never be rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be quick to utter a word before God, for God is in heaven and you upon earth, therefore let your words be few. For dreams come with many cares, and a fool's voice with many words. When you make a vow to God, do not delay fulfilling it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Fulfill what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not fulfill it. Do not let your mouth lead you into sin, and do not say before the messenger that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your words and destroy the work of your hands? With many dreams come vanities and a multitude of words, but fear God.